I'd like to call the House Finance Budget Subcommittee, Department of Health and Social Services, FY14 Operating Budget to order. Today is Wednesday, February 20th, 2013. The time is 8:25. Members present are Representative Munoz, Kawasaki, Representative Costello, Representative Thompson, Edgman, Wilson, myself, Chair Newman. I do expect Representative Osterman and Stoltz here shortly, so we will recognize them now. With that, we have today presentations on the Division of Public Health with Dr. Hurlburt, really exciting program, and then later with the Alaska Care Commission with Deborah Erickson and Dr. Hurlburt. Name and affiliation, please. And we're going to go through this and then ask questions when we're done, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ward Hurlburt. I'm the Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health and Social Services. And with me is Jill Lewis, who's the Deputy Director of Division of Public Health based here in Juneau.
Good morning.
It's a privilege to be here. Shall I go ahead, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir, Doctor.
Right into it. Thank you. You have on the next slide, slide two, and I'll try to say where we are periodically on that. This outlines what we want to cover in the presentation. Next slide, please, Jill. In the state's constitution, our constitution identifies that it is a state responsibility for public health for the citizens of Alaska. And different states are different. In some states, it's a mixed between localities and the state, and others, it's largely localized. In Alaska, it's a state responsibility. We do, however, contract now with three jurisdictions for significant public health services, namely public health nursing services, with Manalik, North Slope Borough, and a large contract with Anchorage, formerly did with Norton Sound. Otherwise, the state operates public health nursing services. We have the core services that that our efforts fit into. These are consistent with the core services of the department. Commissioner Struer has worked with all the divisions so that we collaborate with each other, with other departments as well, and that we focus on a unified set of core services that you see there. Next slide, please. And the next one. This shows the organization. We have 10 sections within the Division of the Public Health, and we'll be talking about those today. We want to look back initially at the past 10 years of the budget, and next slide, please. You notice the top curve there, I believe it's red in your books, doesn't show up on the blue, purple rather, with triangles on that, and that's nursing. Shows a attention getting increase in budget for public health nursing there. And there are three main reasons for that. One was that there was about $4 million back where the curve started up sharply. And that was just before I started into my position here about 3.5 years ago. But that was to replace federal money. The accounting for Medicaid dollars going to nursing really put us in some jeopardy, and with Commissioner Struer's leadership in his former life and working with the division there, there was $4 million that replaced those federal funds, and so that was a big bump up. The second factor, almost as big, $3.7 million that came over a three-year period. What happened going back into the 90s with the four then contracted entities that I mentioned, Anchorage, the large one, North Slope, Manalik, Norton Sound, for the public health nursing services, when the state budget for public health nursing went up with the annual pay increases, increases in utility costs, and so on, those contracting entities were not made whole. And so they were needing to dig more and more into their pocket. Commissioner Mayor Sullivan, for example, said, I don't mind doing this, it's a state responsibility, but we shouldn't be subsidizing it. And so over a three-year period, they were made whole on that. And finally, there was a programmatic $2.2 million increase because they were needing to operate with an 18% vacancy factor. There's not travel money to get the nurses out, and that's what they need to do. The second, the red line with the diamonds is epidemiology. That one, there was a $5.1 million increase on that. Up through 2008, Alaska was unique, and this was with Senator Ted Stevens' influence, that we were given universal vaccine money. We could immunize all the kids in the state, whether they had insurance, no insurance, Medicaid, or whatever. And when Senator Stevens lost in that election, CDC gradually moved us to the position that other states are, namely that we have federal funding for Medicaid and Alaska Native children, but not for others. About 25% of the kids are covered with private health insurance, Premier, Aetna, whatnot, and that pays for it. About another 25% are underinsured or uninsured. And in the governor's budget last year, which the legislature approved, there was, first time since statehood, $700,000 put into our base. In addition, there was about a $5.3 million budget item initially championed by Senator Geisel for providing for 3 years vaccines for children that are underinsured and overinsured, with the clear intent that we need to work out some way during that time period to cover that, and we're in negotiations and working with the insurance companies, working with the state of Washington, which was able to do that, and other states to replace that. The final, the third one, the green line, is health planning systems, and that makes a bump up when that first came into the division, or not the first time, but this time, coming back to the division, that budget, which had been at the bottom when it wasn't in the division for the division money, made a bump up. And then there was the added money that came into health planning for the scholarship, for the loan repayment program for providers of various kinds there. Next and slide.
Dr. Hilbert, I'd like to take a minute to recognize Representative Guerra. Thank you, Representative Guerra.
Next slide, Joe, please. We want to talk a little bit about the program, the largest program that we have, public health nursing, about 40% of our staff. The nurses are around the state. They are located in 26 public health nursing centers here in Dillingham, here in Juneau, in Dillingham, in many communities around the state, and they travel to 250 communities around the state, providing immunizations, doing disease investigation, providing prenatal care, and so on. Next slide, epidemiology is our next biggest section, and they do disease investigation. For example, if there's a norovirus outbreak, say on ships, they get involved looking at it. There's a TB outbreak, venereal disease, whatnot, they're involved. Next slide. Women, children, and family health, the old maternal and child health programs, deal with women's health, children's health. The Alaska received an award last fall for the improvement that we've had in reducing the incidence of low birth weight babies. We do quite well on that. Next slide, chronic disease prevention. These are where programs are related to these red shirts, overweight and obesity. I think the dominant public health challenge for our state, for our country, for this century, and that we're just getting started in. The tobacco programs are there, a number of other programs there, injury prevention, unintentional injury, biggest killer of Alaskans from ages 1 through age 44. We've had real improvement there. Kids Don't Float program, starting out in Homer, spreading across the whole country, was there. Next slide. The health planning I mentioned. Emergency programs. Thank you, Jill. Emergency programs is where we have 4,000 mostly volunteer EMTs located around the state. It has to do with disaster planning. If we had an Alaska Airlines crash coming into Juneau or Anchorage or somewhere else, these folks would get involved. Next slide. Health planning is where we have the loan repayment program, where there are difficult to recruit for, say, family medicine docs to get them in, particularly into rural areas. They are there. They have to do with developing other rural capabilities in healthcare. Next slide. The lab provides the testing. For example, if a white powder is delivered to the Capitol here, to the legislative offices, or the governor's office, or the police department here, all of which have happened, That powder goes to the lab to determine what is this. Is it just baking powder, or is it something, ricin, that we need to be serious about? When I was in Representative Edgman's hometown of Dillingham, when ECOC was a year-round community, we had an outbreak of typhoid. And that was 50 years ago, but even then, typhoid fever was very uncommon in the U.S. The lab, as it existed then on 3rd Avenue at the time in Anchorage, diagnosed that, and we were able to follow through on that. Next, Bureau of Vital Statistics. These are the folks where you get your birth certificates, your marriage certificates, your death certificates, your divorce certificates when that happens. They maintain the vital statistics for us there. The next slide, State Medical Examiner's Office. This is where, with the tragic day's death of that lovely young 13-year-old girl in Cake, where her body went to determine what was the cause of death. And that's the determination that was a murder there. They have close to 1,000 cases that they look at each year. That if you watch Ropes, that's what happens in Alaska there. We have 3 outstanding forensic pathologists there. Next slide, please. The accomplished, I'd like to mention briefly 3 mentioned healthy futures, that obesity and overweight, the dominant public health challenge. Direct medical care costs related to the complications of overweight and obesity have now surpassed that for tobacco. CDC projects that of babies being born in the U.S. now, 38% of girl babies, 34% of boy babies are at risk of diabetes. If you're a 40-year-old woman and you're diabetic, you die 14 years earlier. And so that's in there. Tobacco, CDC gives Alaska an A. We do the best job of any state in the country, and that's in terms of budget in our anti-tobacco efforts. For our adults, we're number 35 in the state still. We were number 48, so that's significant improvement. We were like Mississippi or Kentucky or some of the southeastern states there. For young people, for adolescents, we're number 9 among the states, and that's huge improvement, and that's favorable. The money comes from the tobacco settlement money with the tobacco companies from the tobacco taxes. When Governor Parnell was chair of the Senate Finance Committee 13, 14 years ago now, there was something that he championed, and your colleagues and your predecessors in the legislature and the succeeding governors have continued to have a commitment to that, and so we continue to have that program. It's still going to be out there. We still have a lot of folks that we need to do. The biggest challenge among the Alaska Native population, where almost 40% of Alaska Native adults still smoke, but a success story. Immunization is the third priority that I wanted to mention there. There's what's known as the parental hesitancy rate. Now, parental hesitancy is where parents say, I don't want my kids to get immunized. We have 9%, it's the highest in the country. That creates a problem. The vaccine-preventable diseases are still common, and we still work on that. As I mentioned, we were number 49 among the states on that. We're now number 34, so we've improved, but we need to do better to protect our kids and to protect our adults. The next slide on the budget increments, want to mention these. We had the increased funding this fiscal year for the public health nursing grantees, now the 3 left, Norton Sound, North Slope, and Anchorage being the biggest one. Anchorage is very leanly staffed for public health nursing, less than a fourth, about an eighth actually of what the rest of the state is staffed. Probably not totally inappropriate because there are more other medical resources there. But their salaries are likewise lower, but they do a good job. And this at least made them whole so that at their operating level and their operating budget, they're not taking it out of other funds, and Mayor Sullivan's not saying that's a state responsibility. If it came back to the state, quite honestly, it would be a huge problem for the whole state. Immunizations, mentioned that. Loan repayment, this was the expansion of the program there using mental health trust funds. And finally, there was the STD program that the legislature added last year, $360,000, directed mainly toward chlamydia, in which Alaska is generally number 1 or number 2 states there. Next slide, please. On the programs, we do anticipate being able to obligate the money. The medical providers program that had the addition last year, where if a physician, a pharmacist, a nurse comes in a specialty that's needed, like family medicine, goes to a hard-to-fill area, the state will agree to pay back their loans up to as much as $45,000 a year for 3 years. And that program, the expanded program, is just starting this year, so we're enrolling new individuals in it. They'll have three-year contracts. So far, our success rate with the old program at matching providers and communities is pretty good. And a success is where they decide to stay after their loan repayment's over, and it's worked out pretty well. Small amount of money for naturally occurring asbestos. This is particularly geared toward Ambler for building a road going to the airport, airport servicing, where there's asbestos in the rock there. Next slide, please. These are some of the priorities that we have. Mentioned obesity, the dominant public health problem that we have. I won't go over that again. I think I'll probably have it up. Next slide. Likewise with some of these others mentioned, still the most deadly public health problem is tobacco. Kills more people than anybody else, although obesity is coming up on that and remains a challenge. Next slide. Immunizations, talked about the money that came last year, both in the governor's budget and added by the legislature, was the first time that had ever happened since statehood. So I think we, and on behalf of other Alaskans, are really grateful to what the state did, because it does protect our kids. Next slide, please. Water fluoridation. This is a particular problem for Alaska. Around the country, we keep seeing more and more water systems fluoridated. About 75% of Americans are on that. Their studies have been done by CDC in Alaska and urban areas outside. Water fluoride, even when you use fluoridated toothpaste, significantly reduces dental decay. But we have, in Juneau, we do not fluoridate the water. In Fairbanks, we do not now. Anchorage was one of the first cities in the country, and Anchorage continues to, but it's a challenge. Next slide, please.
And Dr. Hulbert, if we can stay away from the acronyms a little bit and make sure that we pronounce those what they are.
Okay.
Center for Disease Control and stuff, but we live in a world of acronyms, but there's a lot of people listening in that don't, so.
We do, yes, thank you. Yeah, Centers for Disease Control, that you mentioned, the National Infectious and Communicable Disease Agency. Unintentional injury, mentioned that. We've had major success there. One of the programs for that has been the Code Blue, and that's runs about, at most years, about $450,000. There's been a good match, 4 or 5 to 1, big source of funds to the Department of Agriculture, and that that money is drawing down. That program, in my mind, is one of the best things I've seen government do. The money comes from that, both the state general fund money and the matching money, and then the emergency medical people from the regions around the state get together, and they decide that Cactovic has a need this year, or Craig has a need this year, and they agree on how to allocate that money. And it's what buys the ambulances. It's what buys the defibrillators. It's what buys the other things around the country, and that's worked well for us. Next slide, please. And then infrastructure. We continue to try to make the program more responsive so that we manage it. We had an exercise a year ago last fall with all of our sections of, what if you lose 10% of your federal grant money, which looks like it's a pretty realistic guess. How will you manage it so we do the least harm? This year we said, zero-based budgeting. Just because we've always done it since Ernst Greening was governor in the Senate, doesn't mean we should keep doing it. We've tried to look at it. Does it really make sense? So we're trying to manage efficiently and effectively. Next slide, please. The budget requests for this year, the first two are really ongoing requests, comes through the Mental Health Trust, but as the process works, the request is repeated each year, so the $200,000 as one of the components of the loan repayment program is there. Likewise, $75,000 for an autism workshop. These are largely programs driven by the Mental Health Trust. And then there is the one new item for the $75,000 for Bureau of Vital Statistics, birth certificates, death certificates, and so on. The legislature, in recognition and to honor the veterans of Alaska last year, excluded them from the need to pay for death certificates there for, up to 5 copies of the death certificates. The Bureau of Vital Statistics basically operates on collected revenue. And we have raised their fees as $30 for a certificate now, which is kind of mid-range for where the rest of the country is on that. That basically pays the operating cost, not the new capital cost like the request for the data system this year. But because of excluding the veterans, we either had to raise the fees or have the money inserted. And that wasn't done in the current fiscal year. It is in the request for this fiscal year and in next year's budget. Next slide, please.
And just briefly on that, members, I'd like to point out the requests for the $275,000 from MHTR. We expect those to be continued to come through Mental Health Trust. And their biggie this year is the $75,000 for death certificates. So, I mean, Dr. Hilbert's running this on a pretty good shoestring this year. I just want to make sure we pointed that out.
I think the next slides you have there, and I won't go through those in detail, but I want to mention one other thing that we do. We have we're learning and we're improving on that. But we're using what we call dashboards for each of our sections. And we maintain a large picture of the dashboard in the office here. This is a picture of all the dashboards. But for each of our sections, we have this. And they report each month. We're trying to quantify what we do. And as I say, we're learning. But this is used much more in private industry than in a lot of places in government. It can be very helpful. It may be service issues. How long does it take to answer the phone if you're calling in for a service from government? Or what's your immunization rate? Those kinds of things. It's a tool that we're using. The commissioner has encouraged us in that, and we're posting those. I'd like to stop now and respond to any questions that you may have.
Just about that. Okay, thank you. And then, Dr. Hilbert, if we could get electronic copies of the extra information you've got, we'll make sure we distribute that to the members. And then we will have a few extra copies available for the public that might want to see them. And again, we went through this fairly fast, and we discussed this last night. These are some of the things that we're going to be going over probably in pretty extensive review this summer as we go continue to work through this, and particularly I'll just say it now, the next presentation that we go through that looks at some of the costs of what it costs to deliver health care in the state and comparing to other states, it's pretty dramatic. So we'll be doing that quite extensively throughout the summer. So I just want to make sure members know we are going to be revisiting this. Representative Wilson and Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're talking about the health. How are we doing with PE and schools? I know that it used to be 5 days a week. I know sometimes it's not even a couple days. Are you keeping track of that with our schools and how that fits into your whole plan on health?
We have a good collaborative relation with Department of Education and Early Development, but we're not doing well. If you want to be a PE teacher, you can't get a degree in Alaska. And there has been less and less PE. Partly we thought, well, other countries like Korea, Japan, some of the Scandinavian countries are doing better than we are in school. So let's do more reading, writing, and arithmetic and not as much PE. We know now that kids that are physically active in school do better academically. So a part of the Healthy Futures program, what this specific program is to get elementary kids to sign up for 30 minutes of physical activity, preferably with their parents, outside the school day. And it's done twice a year for 3 months, so they keep track of it, they keep a log, and if they fulfill their commitment every month, they'll get a small prize, like a jump rope with a clicker, to encourage them to be active. A part of our efforts in working with schools, and we've had good relations, particularly with Anchorage and with MATSU, where their superintendents, their school boards, have been involved. They've improved the quality of the school lunches. They've gotten sugar-sweetened beverages out of the schools. They've increased physical activity. And we have seen in Anchorage and MATSU a small but statistically significant decrease in the average body mass index, BMI, for their school kids in the last two-year measuring period. It may be a blip, but it could be changing a trend. We've gotten some national attention for that. Last fall, the Kenai Peninsula School District also signed up, so we now have 57% of the kids in the state in programs that we're working on. We're doing a little bit, But it's moving in the right direction, and it's very important that they do that. Thank you.
And I just had another question. On the immunizations, you kind of skipped over it. You said that 7% were opting out on immunizations. One of, I guess, we're the top state that has that. Do you have any idea why it's that high? Is it religious choice, or is it because parents just you can't afford it? Do we know why?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's actually 9%. It is the highest state. And there are a number of reasons. There are a lot more shots available and recommended than there used to be, so it's a lot of sticks for a little kid, and that can be hard on a mom. But we also, for example, in 1953 in Ketchikan, when there were about 5,000 people there, in a nine-month period, there were 93 people that developed polio, 83 were paralytic. There was no resistance to polio vaccine. Now polio is a distant memory. I can remember iron lungs and maybe a few others in the room can, but not many. So we're not as aware. When I was in Dillingham, we lost kids every year that came in with measles there, with measles pneumonia, measles empyema. We don't see much measles now, so people aren't as scared. And we're more sophisticated sometimes to our harm, where we think, well, we really don't need the shot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and not today, but I just wanted to bring to light on the autism. We also have a portion of that in education, and maybe at a later date we need to see why we have that in two different departments to make sure we're not duplicating. But I think it's a bigger discussion than what we want to do today.
Okay, and I think you just talked to the commissioner to make sure that we're looking at that. Dr. Hobel, just on the point there, did you say that getting a teacher's educational degree for physical education is not available in Alaska?
That's my understanding, that there's not a degree program, Mr. Chairman, for PE here.
Okay. Well, I think maybe our folks who work for the university, Representative Munoz and Wilson, and our local educator with Representative Costello will probably be looking at that a little bit longer. I noticed Representative Munoz's hand was coming up pretty quick on that one. Representative Costello, then Munoz.
Thank you. I think Representative Wilson is reading my mind, because both of my comments have to do with healthy futures in PE and also immunizations. I just wanted to say that I'm a huge fan of the Healthy Futures campaign. My family participates and my office participates, so if anyone is looking for a calendar on your way out in room 501, we have extra copies. My son earned a jump rope with a clicker, and it changed our family life for a while as he practiced jumping, and I think he at age 6 he can jump rope 14 times consecutively, and he's very proud of that. And so I think this is a voluntary program, and it's an excellent program that that the department is promoting. I too am concerned about the eroding of PE in our schools, and I think that we all know the mind-body connection is very important, and to have that activity during the school day, we see fewer visits to the principal's office, fewer discipline problems, more engaged students when kids are active. And so I'll be working with Representative Wilson on looking at how we can encourage kids to be outside and active during the school day. I'm also very concerned about immunizations, and I supported the bill last session to backfill the loss of federal funds. And my concern is that, you know, in my family's, you know, when we immunized my sons, my husband and I were able to go to the public health clinic. A visit to a doctor's office costs us $250, even if it's just for immunizations, and the immunizations were about $15. And so I was curious, is there any effort to make it easier for people who do have insurance but it doesn't cover the doctor's visit to reduce that cost? Because it's really, you know, I believe in immunizations, and I'll sit there and hold my child while they're crying, but it really hurts me more in the pocketbook than it did emotionally. So can you respond to the high costs that Alaskans pay just simply to go see a doctor?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Costello. On the Healthy Futures, as you saw on the slide, 142 schools around the state. And I should note, this is a public-private partnership. The division puts the most money in, $125,000 a year. Providence Health Systems puts $100,000 in. ConocoPhillips, $25,000, and other businesses, lesser amounts. So it's a real collaborative thing. related to the kids being active. On the immunizations, Senator Geisel has been very clear that her expectation and her intent is that the department figure out how to get this funded over this three-year period, that we would receive the money. And so we have had meetings and discussions with other states that have done it, like Washington, like New Hampshire, like Maine, like Minnesota. And we have had a lot of discussions with, particularly with Premera as the largest insurer here, and the group that, chairs the task force dealing with that in Washington State, looking at that. We are trying to work it out so that it costs less. It doesn't help your family, but for example, Margaret Brody here was able to make the change on Medicaid so that there was no copay for Medicaid enrollees getting immunizations. We're wanting to make it as easy as we can. I know that Commissioner Hultberg is very committed to preventive kinds of services and encouraging people to do that. So yes, it is something that's on the horizon, and it is a real issue, and it's a real discourager to have that kind of money charged. The total cost just for the vaccines now are like $1,700-$1,800 for in the first 2 years of life. It used to be cheap, and it's not anymore.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Well, one area that I'm very concerned about is the area of food requirements and the lack of food requirements for the food stamp programs and perhaps other state-run programs in the state of Alaska. And I'm just thinking that with the high rate of childhood obesity, that there must be a direct correlation between a family's purchase of unhealthy foods and high sugar content foods and our ability to be able to combat that epidemic. And I'm just wondering, is there any effort on the national level with the states to try to address food requirements through the food stamp program?
I'm not an expert on that, and Mr. Crerar, who's here, would be far more knowledgeable than I am. Working collaboratively between the divisions with our person in charge of our overweight and obesity program, we were able to have food stamps be able to be used in farmers markets to try to buy the healthy foods and to support farming in Alaska. So there's been sensitivity and effort to doing that. On the sugar sweetened beverages, it's very much correlated with the increase in obesity. And the finger is often pointed at the McDonald's or at the Cokes or Pepsis and so on. I had the opportunity to meet with the government affairs people from the West Coast for Coke, for Dr. Pepper, for Pepsi, and a national person from Washington, D.C. for the U.S. Beverage Association. They are very committed to getting the sugar-sweetened beverages out of schools, and they say their companies and their bottlers will not place the sugar-sweetened beverages in elementary schools now, they bring in other beverages that they want to sell, the artificially sweetened ones, or you can go to McDonald's and get a healthy meal now. So I think that this has been a factor, but I believe those industries can be partners. They're concerned about the health of Americans the same as we are, and they're not just an enemy. I think we can collaborate and try to address those issues because it's very much a part of it. And it's not just overweight and obesity. It's the dental caries that's so bad. I remember a survey in Wainwright years and years ago where the average per capita consumption was 7 cans of pop a day, which was totally unbelievable. Now, it was cheaper than water, and you could understand that, but it's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr.
Yeah. So I'm thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy that the school lunch programs across the state are improving. I think we've come a long way in the last 10 years or so. But we need to do a lot more in terms of what is allowed to be purchased with federal money, federal and state money. And it's an issue that has been brought to my attention by people in the medical community. And I think we need to do more to address the problem and try to be more proactive. Thank you.
Again, it's probably a good time to give a shout out and recognize the effort that Representative Stoltz has put forward on making sure that we get Alaska growing. food into our lunches, too. It's a big effort on his part. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. A few things. I just want to make sure some things are working. Let's go to the topic of school lunches and physical activity. Senator McGuire and I had a bill to create a task force to spread physical activity education through all the schools in Alaska. And in schools that don't have a gym, the answer was taking kids out for a walk. It got blocked by one of the senators who felt that was creating a nanny state to do that. But the two issues, what is it going to take and who is going to do it to spread adequate physical education and acceptable food content for kids during school lunches to every school in Alaska? Because I appreciate the efforts that we've made so far, but I'd like to see that done by the food issue done by next year, and the physical education issue at least have a plan to get to every school. I was frustrated when our bill was blocked. This is almost 8 years ago, but it might have to be dusted off. So when will we have physical education of some sort in every school in Alaska, and when will we have healthy, calorie-appropriate, fat-appropriate, sugar-appropriate meals in every school in Alaska? It's not fair to rural students to not get what urban students are getting.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't know, and I don't know that anybody could answer for sure. As we deal with the school districts, the decision making is school district by school district. I've had conversations with Commissioner Hanley, and I know he's certainly very committed to having healthy kids and doing the kinds of things you talk about, but the decisions are made at the school district level. And it was decisions made by Carol Como, for example, and the school board when she was there in Anchorage, that brought about the changes in those schools, getting out the sugar-sweetened beverages, improving the lunches. So, and there are interested individuals. The mayor of, I think it's maybe Barrow, could be North Slope Borough, I'm not sure. I know is interested in that kind of thing. We are looking within the division to try to identify funding that we can free up to work with school districts to incentivize them to want to do those kinds of things. But we don't have, and we might not want, a monolithic system where we decide here in Juneau that's what you have to do. There's more local control. So it's working one district at a time. Is why I was so pleased to say we now have 57% of the kids with those three school districts engaged with us.
Thank you. But 57% means that 43% aren't getting it, right? Don't we have statewide, can we impose statewide nutritional standards for schools? I mean, and I know it might require that we give a little bit of extra money to some of the rural schools where that food is hard to get to, but can't we impose that by regulation?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't know. I think I would probably have to ask the legal people.
Okay.
That may be a little difficult when we have to start analyzing caribou stew. And I mean, that's a lot of the different type of meals that are served in rural, Alaska that doesn't follow the standard menus that we do maybe in.
Let me move on to another subject, Mr. Chair. It's the nutritional value. It could be caribou stew, and that's fine. Right. That's it's just the sugar amounts and the fat amounts and the simple carbohydrate amounts are the things that are very leading to obesity. Immunizations. Let me ask you about this. I support obviously the immunization program, but there's a general sense by people that the immunization program is there and the money is there, but families aren't sending their children to get immunized. So. Is all of the money being spent on immunization that you have, or is there money left over because families aren't bringing their children in for immunizations?
Through the chair, Representative Kerr, the money that we have, specifically the first money since statehood, the big addition last year, we will spend.
On immunizations?
On vaccines, yes.
Okay. And through the chair, one other question. Yes. I'm a big fan of public health nurses. This is an impression I've heard from some people. that while public health service nurses offer very important services to people who don't have access to medical care, that often they're not used. They'll go to a community and folks won't use them, or they're in Anchorage and folks won't use them. Can you tell me that the public health nurses that we have are being fully utilized and not just traveling to places where people aren't using them? And if the concern that I've heard around is true, then what's the answer to that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I would say that the only reasonable answer is no. They're not most efficiently utilized, and that's a part of our job and our challenge to see that they are. That was why we requested more money for travel, because they were saying, what a money we can't get out. Well, you might as well not have them. There are a number of locations where formerly, in my professional life, we had public health nurses around the state, like King Salmon, like Galena, like Fort Yukon, and it was felt we could not recruit people, we could not staff them, so they're more centralized. So then now they travel from Anchorage to go out on the Aleutian Chain, for example. And I think we need to be open to the possibility of getting them out closer to the people more. But we are trying to look at, like the dashboards that I showed you, tracking what's done. But no, sir, I think there is room for improvement, and that's a part of the job that we have to try to make that optimal. We try to have an environment that the challenge is getting people immunized. It's not jumping through administrative hoops. It's not asking for somebody for their 1040 to say, well, I can give it to you or I can't. If they say, no, I'm not covered, no, I don't have the money, get the kids immunized.
Mr. Chair, did actually there's one other.
Garrett, if we could, I'd like to get to the next presentation because yeah. I would like to open that up to some questions, and we're going to be coming back again in the summer on this. But the next presentation has a lot to do with the cost of health care in Alaska, the rising cost of health care in Alaska, and comparative cost between Alaska and other states. And I would like to let members ask questions during that next presentation, particularly when we get around page 16 or so, when we start looking at different states and the rising costs. And it's just going to take a little bit of time to get through that, I think. So very, very important one, and it's pretty shocking, the numbers that we're going to see here. And so if we could get on with that one first, I'd appreciate that. And we can come back if we have time afterwards. Deborah?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Deborah Erickson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Healthcare Commission. And I'm going to just take a couple minutes to go through a little bit about a process and then turn it over to Dr. Hurlburt to talk a little bit about the cost concerns. The Healthcare Commission was established by the legislature in statute during 2010. We have been working on producing recommendations for addressing issues related to cost, quality, and access of care. For the governor and the legislature, we produce an annual report each January. And the composition of the commission is designated in statute. It actually is primarily representing the healthcare industry. For the most part, and the members are appointed by the governor. We've been spending some time each year we started out with identifying a vision of where we think the healthcare delivery system in Alaska needs to be in the next 10 or 15 years, and we're kind of dividing up our time and our resources each year, spending some time studying where we're at today while we keep that vision of the future in mind and understanding what the issues and the problems with the system today are, but then at the same time looking at potential solutions and trying to lay out a roadmap for, in terms of state government policy, what are some of the solutions that state government can affect to move us down the road towards an improved healthcare system. Our vision is that by 2025, Alaskans will be the healthiest people in the nation and have access to the highest quality, most affordable health care. And in addition to trying to be time specific, we've identified some very high level measures so we can kind of track over time if we're making improvement. In terms of the current studies and where we're at today, we've focused primarily on issues related to cost and cost drivers. I think we believe that the commission probably wouldn't have been established by the legislature and the law signed by the governor if there wasn't, if we hadn't gotten to the point where there was enough concern about the cost of care. So we've been very focused on that and cost drivers, and I've just provided a list here on slide six of the different issues that we focused on, and the you can access our annual reports over the web or give me a call any time if you'd like to access that part of the study of the current system. And I just wanted to note before turning it over to Dr. Hurlburt that while we've been primarily concerned about current problems related to cost and cost drivers, that when we've looked at and considered solutions, you know, high spending for healthcare in and of itself isn't necessarily a bad thing if we're getting a good return on our investment. And so we've tried to stay focused on value, not just cost, and designing those solutions. And just wanted to note that Alaska, we used to be last in the nation in terms of a state for high healthcare spending, the highest healthcare spending in the country per capita. But with the passage of their reform law, Massachusetts passed us up a few years ago. They passed their healthcare reform law in 2005 and now have the highest spending. But in return for the highest per capita spending, that state is number one in terms of healthcare coverage. They have the highest proportion of their population covered by insurance, and are ranked fourth in terms of healthcare quality, and third in terms of health outcomes. So I think the good news is there's lots of room for improvement, and hopefully some of the solutions that we've identified that we'll talk a little bit more about in a few minutes will start moving us in that direction.
Okay. You've heard the presentations that Commissioner Struer and Commissioner Hultberg and their staff have made, and I've watched those, and I've heard the questions you've raised, which have really warmed my heart on that. Healthcare is a huge problem for us. The graph on the left shows selected developed countries, but if you take the 37 industrialized countries around the world, we are in the United States between 50 and 100% higher in cost as a percent of gross domestic product and in dollars or dollar equivalents than any of those other countries there. And the graph on the left shows that disparity has been widening over the years. When I first came to Alaska and went to Dillingham, we spent as a nation less than $150 per capita for health care. We now spend more than $9,000 per capita for health care, just in my professional lifetime, though I do have gray hair now. The graph on the right shows the percentage of GDP. We're now at about 18%. The Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services projects that within the next few years we will be at about 21 to 21.5% of gross domestic product, and I'll give you some other projections in a few minutes. Next slide, please. For what do we get? Well, we maybe have the best health of anybody in the world. No, we don't. The green line there toward the left is the United States and life expectancy, and these show us other industrialized countries. Next slide, this just puts it in terms of infant mortality rates. Way better than it used to be in our country, but 6.1, Japan at 2.3. Average life expectancy now for a baby born today, 78.7 years. The other countries on the right there, Switzerland, 82.6. We used to say, well, if you got to be 65, we did better here. That's not even true now. So we do not have that value for what we're spending. Next slide, please. This slide shows for the U.S. various components of the cost of living. And the bottom line there with the triangle shows that over this period from 1999 to 2012, there was an overall 38% increase in the cost of living. Salaries increased 47%, so a little better than that. However, that was almost all eaten up, as I'll mention later, by the increased health care costs. And then at the top, the health insurance premiums, 172%. The out-of-pocket costs for consumers, 180%. So it's outstripping, probably with the exception of higher education, outstripping almost every other component of the cost of living. Next slide, please. One slide that I would like to, sorry.
Dr. Robert, just back on the prior slide there. And this is, I think, is a good place to start discussion, Naomi, from a little bit of the committee when we look at this. In the cost of health care, and when we look at the third line down, which is workers' earnings, and then the cost, At what point is it going to be, how far out into the future, and we already discussed this last night, so how far out into the future for the members is it going to be to the point, if we continue at this incline, to where every dollar that a person makes in their job goes to health care, and you won't have money to buy groceries or gas to get to work? Yeah. I mean, if we keep going like this.
Thank you.
That's coming up.
That's the absolute perfect segue to my next slide. Because this is the answer from that radical publication, the Washington Post. And it says that the track that we were on, by 2033, we would spend all of our income on health care for out-of-pocket costs for health insurance premiums. And the headline at the top is because the costs have moderated a little bit, as Commissioner Stewart told you, we're kind of lucky in the cycle right now is probably the main reason. So we've stretched that out to 2037. But by then, no groceries, no gasoline, no fuel to heat your home. Obviously unsustainable. And you have heard Commissioner Struer, Commissioner Hulsberg use the unsustainable word.
And before we get to questions, why, in your opinion, do you think those costs are continuing to rise like that in Alaska?
The costs continue to rise for a number of reasons, I believe. The main reason, the most immediate reason, is that our unit costs are very high. If you go to the hospital for a day, if you go to the doctor to get the immunizations that we have, our charges are very high. Again, in a few minutes, I'll present some data which shows that compared to the other Northwest states or other small population rural states like North Dakota and Wyoming, we're way ahead of what they are in what are charged for office visits, for procedures, for hospital days. We've also had increasing technology. I mentioned last night that when I was in medical school, it was a long time ago, you learn things by mnemonics, we call them. You learn these acronyms. But what we learned for a heart attack was HOPE, H-O-A-P. It's also should we couldn't spell. But it meant humidity. You put them in a mist tent. Oxygen, analgesia, that means pain medicine, and prayer. That's what we had. We didn't have stents. We didn't have the TPA, the drug to dissolve a clot when you go to the emergency room here at Bartlett or Regional or one of the other hospitals. We didn't have the cardiac bypasses. So the technology has helped. A lot of technology does not do good the way it's used, and I'll mention that briefly later. But the technology has been a cost there. And then we have really held up the healthcare sector because so many miracles have happened, and it's been able to get away with charging money. Here in Alaska, there's not been much negotiation. Payers generally have been what would be called rate takers. If a provider says this is what it costs, we haven't had the competition to have that. So I think those are some of the reasons why the costs have grown up.
I think that's an important statement. You know, is because they can, because they can charge more, and Dr. Hulsberg just mentioned competition. But as we've added more medical services are ordered through other doctors, and we had that in some prior discussions. How, particularly if it's within a hospital unit or within a doctor's office. It's kind of somewhat of a complicated issue. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, I understand the 2037, but aren't people making those decisions right now? I mean, isn't it already high enough to where in the rural districts, as well as Fairbanks, with their energy costs where they are right now, that people are choosing not to do, you know, even if they have insurance available because it costs so much just to even get into the plan that they're just choosing not to, then they're not going to the doctor, which means you don't get your wellness care and you're waiting till things get so bad that a high cost is what the bottom line is.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, the 18% currently, that's as much money as the federal government takes in all taxes. And so it's imposing decisions on people. The other very significant factor is the system that we've developed of third-party payers. And we all know the history of during the Second World War when you couldn't give pay raises, employers to reward their loyal, hardworking employees said, we'll provide health insurance. And so we've gotten to the point now that most people have, do not pay much out of pocket. Some companies, like Boeing, for example, has had first dollar coverage, no copays, no deductibles. Well, when somebody else is paying that money, then you don't look at it the same way when you buy a car. There's a drug that's available for advanced prostate cancer that costs several hundred thousand dollars, and it prolongs life on the average, as I recall, about 2 months for several hundred thousand dollars. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal quoting an old Swedish farmer from Minnesota who said, if I was paying that out of my pocket, there's no way I would do that. But somebody else is paying it, so I'll let them spend the several hundred thousand dollars to, on the average, prolong my life by 2 months. That's why some people, as Commissioner Hultberg, for example, suggested that a health savings account where you have more skin in the game, where it's more like you make all your other purchases, then you have an enlightened consumer who's more interested in looking at costs than if somebody else is paying the bill.
Mr. I agree that's part of it, but I know when my husband retired, no insurance came with it. And so with four children and buying it on ourselves, it was going to be something like a couple thousand dollars a month. I mean, more than what his retirement was. So we rolled the dice. I mean, we just tried to keep the kids healthy, told them not to fall off of anything. And, you know, yeah, and I think a lot of people do that, though. I think they're rolling the dice saying that I don't have the alternative. I understand what you're saying, where if people don't have skin in the game with a lot of the care we have for free, but there's a lot of middle-class families out there who are very conscientious about it that literally just can't afford private insurance without, if it doesn't come with some kind of help from work, that I think fits into the higher cost, because literally they're not going for those wellness checks or the immunizations or anything like Rep. Costello talked about, because they can't even pay what the health nurse gives. It would just be very, and I don't think you have those in your statistics, because I think a lot of those just live out there with that worry in hopes that nothing serious happens. So I'm just kind of curious, is that why, you know, some of our costs are going up? Because we're only seeing the major costs, not preventing. But I appreciate it.
Thank you. And, you know, Representative Wilson, I don't think it's just rollouts. It's statewide. It's everywhere that's happening, and people are trying to decide. Representative Costello.
Thank you. I would like to challenge you to find a physician who can tell us what the cost of a procedure is, because I don't think that person exists. Commissioner Hultberg came before the Finance Committee a while ago, and I had to bite my tongue, because she was talking about the consumers being educated and asking about the cost of a procedure. And I can tell you that in my own effort to ask that question, when we go to the doctor, when we're in the room with the doctor, we've asked, can you let us know when this visit moves from a level one to a level two and a level three? Because at that point, we'd like to make a decision about going, you know, that next step. And we don't get that information. And I know that that's something that, you know, we don't really talk about, is that, you know, there is a responsibility on the part of the consumer, but we can't get that information. Physicians do not know what the cost of something is. And when I've gone down that path to try to figure out why does that ignorance exist, and the answer I get is, well, it's different for every person depending on what kind of coverage you have. And I think I'm going to go back and look at the ICER report that's listed here, because I think some of that information is really valuable. But I think that there needs to be transparency as far as the cost, because as a consumer, I want to know what I'll be charged and not have a bill show up or several bills show up, you know, 3 weeks after the appointment for a total cost that our family can't absorb. And I think that transparency is a important element, because my family does try to shop around, and we're not able to shop because physicians and doctor's offices don't have the answer for you. They can only tell you how much it will cost after you visited and after you owe the money. And it's a huge frustration, and I'm sure a lot of families share in that frustration, and I'm not sure what the answer is. But I do think that it would be wonderful if you could go online and know that if I'm taking my family member, or if I go to this particular office, it's going to cost this much. If I go down to the urgent care down the street, it's going to cost this much. And the cost question, I think, is something that we really have to address, and we all know that. So if you don't mind commenting on that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, and we do have some cost comparisons coming up on page 16 for quite a few of those different procedures, and it's interesting that you brought up, and I talked to Dr. Holbert last night. I had your funny bone nerve, the ulnar nerve, moved to my elbow a couple of times. The first time it cost, I texted my wife, was $18,000. The second time, it was $28,000 to do the same procedure because it moved back where it was. And by golly, it's right where God put it anyhow, after two surgeries. But what they did is they just used a different code. The same exact surgery, same procedure, same doctor, same hospital, went from $18,000 to $28,000. And then she just had some surgery on her foot, too, which was much more extensive at a place in Anchorage. It was half of that for a major procedure. But we're going to get into some of those costs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Costello, would it be okay if we quickly go through the next three slides?
Yeah.
And then I respond with the slide in front of us. To that. Thank you. The next slide, please. This just shows what's happening with the total health care cost in Alaska, where we're over $8 billion now and increasing. Next slide. This shows Anchorage component cost of living, bottom line housing. Then this goes back to 1982. The total consumer price index up 195%. Energy up more than that, particularly with the big increase in oil prices the last few years. Medical care costs up 418%. Next slide. This relates a little bit to the kind of point Representative Wilson was making, that more employers are needing to drop insurance there. Next slide. This slide and the next one just show some comparisons, and Representative Commissioner Hultberg gave you some other different examples when she talked. But this was comparing Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and then the North Dakota and Wyoming, in what the costs are for various common codes. And Alaska is by far the highest for all of those. Next slide. I won't go into those in detail. And then the next slide. This relates to the issue that Representative Keller raised there. The physician can't answer what's it going to cost, because it depends on who's paying. This is just in Alaska. The other slides show that we pay so much more than any other state for the various services. But in Alaska, consistently, the only consistency here is that workman's comp pays more than any other payer. But whether you're Medicare, Medicaid, or so on, in most states, Medicaid would be by far the lowest payer. Alaska is one of three states where Medicaid pays more than Medicare. We believe that helps us with access, so Medicaid is higher. So that's why an honest answer is, which helps the patient, not at all. It depends. So to deal with that issue, one of the issues, and Deb will mention it later, but I think it's germane now, 12 states have what's called an all-payer claims database. And it varies a little by state to state. Colorado is the one that most recently came on board. Got a lot of favorable press in the Denver Post and the newspapers there, that you can now go online and say, what is it going to cost? What's the total cost to have a gallbladder operation or a hysterectomy or for a well office visit or a colonoscopy or whatever? You can find out what it's going to cost in various places. There's also a quality component so that you could look at that. There's been a Friedman group that the Healthcare Commission has contracted with, is preparing a report. The final report will be presented on March 7th at our Healthcare Commission meeting there. The final report it will be available online then, or maybe even when we receive it, I guess, to look at the report. They will outline various options. It is something that would cost money to set up the system, but a number of states have done that to try to get that transparency, because when that's missing in the system, you cannot be an informed and enlightened consumer when you're totally blinded or shooting in the dark. So that is a system. They will present four levels of options of completeness of the data if it, say, looks too costly. But it's something that will be a part of what's transmitted to the legislature to the governor's office at something for consideration in trying to help consumers be more knowledgeable and more appropriate consumers. The output data will be there, so you, if you want to have something done, you could look at, well, what are the outcomes? How does Providence do? How does Regional do? How does Valley Hospital do? How does Soldotna do? Or how does Virginia Mason do in Seattle? And make good decisions for yourselves and for your families. That's what you have in an all-payer claims database.
Dr. Hobert, I'm going to just pick page 17, and I'll just ask a couple of questions. First off, the states that you selected, I just want to make sure we're clear on the record here. You did not cherry-pick those states. Those were just randomly selected.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Well, we selected Washington, Oregon, and Idaho because they're close, because they're the other Northwest states, because Seattle and Portland tend to be the centers where more of our folks go. We just kind of out of the air, and I guess I did that, picked North Dakota and Wyoming, thinking of states that are pretty not urbanized. We're probably more urbanized than they are in some ways, but largely rural states with small populations. And then what's not on here on the hospital comparisons, and this was done at the request of the Hospital Association, we added Hawaii for hospital costs. Because we all think of Hawaii, like Alaska, being a high-cost state. The reality is that one of the few components of the cost of living in Hawaii that's not high is health care. So we're a lot higher than Hawaii on those hospital costs there. But that was added at the request of the Hospital Association.
So if I was to look, and I'm on page 17, and look at the hip replacement, I guess that is, you know, $10,500. And other states are about $2,200 to $2,300. Wyoming is $3,300. Can Alaskans go to their hospitals or, you know, doctors who may be doing this type of work and bargain? Is that a practice do we do that in Alaska, where Alaskans typically do that? Because I know that insurance companies are going to say, we're going to pay, you know, a basic standard coverage cost, and anything above that, you're going to have to deal with.
Which you don't want to have happen. All providers have billed charges. That's a movable target. You might charge $10 today. Well, I once won a prize because I came the closest to guessing what one diaper cost in a neonatal intensive care unit, and it was $37.50 for one diaper. I received one of those little MP3 players by coming closest to in my guess there. But it might be that today, and tomorrow it might be $45. So the only reason for contracting at billed charges is to protect your employees or your enrollees, your insured individuals, from balance billing, so that the provider can't say, you have to pay the rest. With a contract, they have to accept what they agree to, which could be billed charges. In the rest of the country, people don't contract at billed charges. We've had a lot of contracting at billed charges here, but I think there's some movement where there's starting to be more of a negotiation, so that a payer, a major payer like the state of Alaska, not as government but as a payer for employees, for retirees, for corrections, for workman's comp, as a huge buyer in the state, is getting more to the place where we can bargain. And I think that's, in a sense, and Commissioner Hultberg said it's like a shot across the bow. We will look at the option of letting people go to Seattle if it's a lot cheaper. Primera, which has a lot of insured business, the biggest insurer in the state, also does a lot of third-party administrator business, TPA business. That means they provide the administrative services, much like the state buys for Alaska Care for me. They provide that for employers, where the employer takes the risk. And their employers are saying to Primera, we want to offer the option of going to Seattle or to Mayo's or Portland or Stanford or wherever else for services for our employees if it can be cheaper. So we're starting to hear talk about that. Everybody wants to maintain our medical capability in Alaska. And we generally have good care here. We have a lot of dedicated people in Alaska, and we want to retain that. There are some services that won't make sense to offer. I used the example last night talking about if you have a bad burn, you have a 30% burn, you should not be cared for in Alaska. You should go to Harborview. That's the number, that's the level one trauma center for all Washington State, for Idaho, for Alaska, and for probably the lifetime of everybody in this room. That's going to make most sense. We don't have the workload to have that kind of a level one trauma center, but we want level two trauma centers here. So there'll be some things you should go outside for. Some of it's going to be competition. If you're going to have heart surgery, should you have it done here, or do you want to go to St. Vincent's in Portland or to Mayo's or somewhere else? To get the kind of information that Representative Costello talked about will help make that decision.
Yeah, without trying to put a panic in our medical providers, but it's a question I think that has to be asked. As a legislature, what is your sense of where we should maybe do what we can to help protect Alaskans who have to cover these costs? We looked at the increases compared to their wages. And we all hear from the businesses in Alaska and what it costs for insurance to cover their employees that continue to increase. At what point do you feel that maybe the legislature should, or should we step in and say that procedures like this can only charge so much above or beyond what a standard average cost is? I mean, because when we're looking at these costs here that are five times average in these other states, is there a point where we should look at maybe looking at our statutes again? I'll make sure we say this clearly and saying that, you know, that you can only charge just so much above what standard costs are.
Where we have statutes and regulations, and there are not a lot of those, but for example, have the regulation that a payer needs to pay at the 80th percentile. And where you have a limited number of payers, say cardiology groups or cardiac surgery groups, they can pretty well set the market, and that can change. That's an extraordinary thing. I've never lived or known any other state where there's a similar provision. And that helps, that mitigates against having a good open marketplace there. Medical malpractice cost issues are a big problem around the country, but Alaska is one of the most enlightened states in the country. The things that the legislature has done on two different occasions over the last 10 years have really created an environment where if an individual is harmed, they can seek to be compensated for that, for the cost of the harm, and to be made whole, but there are caps on that amount. That means the malpractice premiums for physicians, while they still will sound like a huge amount of money, are not like the $300,000 or $400,000 that an obstetrician will pay in Miami-Dade County, for example, just before they do anything else to pay their malpractice premium. We don't have anything like that here. So I think that I believe the marketplace can work. We do need to have the competition between Alaska and other places. And I think that, as I mentioned before, I think that there are so many unique ethical and moral dimensions to healthcare that it's better led the changes by people in the business that understand that, and I think they will, but I think they need some heat. McDonald's would charge $10 for a Big Mac if they could sell them and get away with it. Or a McDonald's salad, since we talked about obesity, that they would charge $10 for that, and we might not buy it for that, but we might buy it for $6 or $7. Dollars there. I think that that's true in healthcare, and so the payers, the state as a huge payer, the insurers like Aetna, like Premera, the employers that self-insure need to bring the pressure, but then I think the market can work, and if the change is led by physicians, by hospital administrators, by others in the field, we will make less mistakes. Bruce Lamoureux, who is the CEO, the president for Providence Health Systems, for all of the Providence Hospital, the other things that Providence has in the state. I have quotes from two people on my wall, and one is from Bruce. And Bruce clearly recognizes that the unsustainable word that Commissioner Hultberger's used, that Commissioner Struer's used, that others have said. Bruce recognizes that. And so if the Bruce Lamoureux, along with the physicians and others, can lead the change, I think that's a better way to do that. Where there are legislative impediments, we would want to remove them, but I don't think that's the answer. I think that what will happen, though, as you see more pressure on payers, you will have folks from the Medical Association, from the Hospital Association, and it's a field that I love. I love hospitals. I love healthcare, and I feel so blessed to be in it for my life. But the pressure will need to come on them. Part of the reaction will be to go to the governor, to go to you all, to say, what are you doing? You're going to put us out of business. We can show you what the profit margins are with the Milliman study that we have done. And for the urban hospitals, they're very significant, very high. So there's room for business to work, for negotiations to work. You folks will feel some of the spinoff as pressures come.
And it is my intent to take a look at that and invite them to come and talk to us about this again. When we look at healthcare, I don't think I went, you know, this last fall and talked to anybody who was not concerned about that or some of the questions that we had to do and, you know, in different surveys or interviews, you know, when we were running for offices. What are we going to do about healthcare costs in the state? We're going to have to address that. We're going to have to try and be as open as we can. But it's a huge situation. Representative Guerra.
I thank you. I really appreciate this. I appreciate all of the research you've done to show us the problems, which are that we charge way more than other states. Certainly, there should be some sort of cost premium for Alaska, which is a more expensive place to do business, but this is crazy. One of the rules you mentioned is one that I've talked about in the past also, which is that other states authorize insurance coverage up to maybe 50 or 60% of what the average cost is for that procedure, but we offer you compensation up to the 80th percentile. But you say that's a regulation. Is that something the department is considering reevaluating? Because, and that's not going to change all of this, because if you reduce prices by 30%, we're still going to be double what some of the other places are. But is that an issue that you're going to look at? Towards changing?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's not something within our department. I believe that's the Division of Insurance would deal with that, but it's an issue that has been raised and aired. In fact, Primera pays, they're required to pay at the 80th percentile. They do pay at the 90th percentile. They have done that to maintain access for their enrollees, to maintain good relations with providers. But that's not something that this department would be the one to do.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's frustrating because I think this is the second or third year in a row we've talked about this, and it's still the same. So I guess we have to hear from the Division of Insurance, but which I think maybe we weren't even planning on hearing from. But that's frustrating that the department can't work with the Division of Insurance to come up with a policy that makes sense. How do we, if you look at the hip replacement one that Representative Newman mentioned, so even if we went to the 50th percentile, or let's say 60th percentile, so we could try and keep good doctors up here, that still doesn't change the hip replacement cost, which is differential, which is $10,000 here and $2,000 everywhere else. So how does that ever change?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I would just like to comment that as far as working with the Division of Insurance, that there has been good collaboration. The former representative of the administration of the governor on the health care commission was Linda Hall, the former director of insurance there, The new director, Brett Kolb, has met with Deb and me and is very cognizant of what's happening. So it's pretty open there, but that's not, the decision making is not within our department. As far as the cost, I think that competition, which needs to include alternatives, I believe if you have a hip, Are you going to go to Bartlett or Fairbanks Memorial or Regional or Prav or Wassel or Soldaten or Ketchikan, I guess, where those might be done, Kodiak probably, or are you going to go to Seattle? That will drive the competition, and rather than specifying a certain percent, as I say, if it's a percent of billed charges, it's a totally moving target. So it really doesn't get you where you want to go. I think that the competition and the ability to say that it's not sustainable. When the costs are higher here in some areas, we know if when we pay some of our costs, they're higher. Restaurant meals are certainly higher generally in Alaska. But in the survey that we did looking at nursing costs for hospitals, they're only about 2% higher in the Anchorage area than they were in the comparison states outside. So some things are a little bit higher, but not very much. Most people, I think, can accept maybe in the 20 to 30% range overall. Costs have been higher here historically.
And I think I want to try and make sure we get through the rest of this. And again, this is something that we're going to come back to again. And I just wanted to make sure people had a chance to address some of these questions here. So if we can, we're going to have to move on, I think, Dr. Hulbert, to try and get through the presentation.
I'll go ahead and take over, and I'll, Dr. Hulbert will help out with a couple of explanations here, but I want to refer to just one other handout you have. I know you have a lot of paper in front of you, but that we do have a document where we've pulled together from over the past few years all of the more detailed recommendations the Commission has made into a single document, so you have that handy. But a couple of just some of the main concepts that we've been focused on as we've developed these recommendations is understanding that a good proportion of the population isn't spending much of the resources on healthcare. Nationally, 50% of the population required 3% of all healthcare spending, and 5% of the population required 50% of healthcare spending. I know when Commissioner Hultberg presented on the Alaska Care Plan specifically, that discrepancy was even bigger, that 5% of the plan members spent 59% of all resources. And so the approach that, again, just in general that we've been looking at as we've been designing these strategies is to in part focus on prevention and how we keep the healthy 50% of the population healthy, or what can government policy do to support people to live healthy lifestyles. Beyond that, to the extent we all will require some healthcare services at some point, and then there are some folks who are very ill and have multiple complex conditions, how can we make the healthcare delivery system more innovative in meeting their needs and also supporting them as consumers? And just another concept, this is a study that just came out from the Institute of Medicine a couple of months ago, but we've heard over time that there's an estimated 30% of all healthcare spending is wasted, and this new report identifies some of the sources of that waste, and we've been particularly focused on a couple of the biggest pieces of that pie there, unnecessary services, inefficient care delivery, and then also inflated prices. So,
Deborah?
Yes, sir.
On page 23 there, is there a way that we can get one of those graphs on Alaska healthcare so that when we look at this again next summer, we can kind of comparatively look at Alaska that way?
Mr. Chair, I believe the Institute of Medicine actually reviewed a number of studies that were done at the national level. I don't know if we could...
Let's see if we can do that one.
We'll look into that.
So
the recommended strategies, again, we've taken the more detailed recommendations and grouped those into these major concepts, strategic approaches, to how we'll address that. And we'll just highlight a couple points related to each of these areas real quickly here and can answer any questions about those. But I'll turn it over to Dr. Hulbert to talk about our first one related to evidence-based medicine.
This evidence-based medicine is a concept that's difficult to understand. If I spent my full time reading medical articles, I might be able to read one-tenth of 1% of the articles that come out in the English language. Now, it's difficult to keep up with. There, among folks who have looked at the system, and this was initially expressed in the very first meeting of the Healthcare Commission when Governor Palin established it and before I had come on board, that somewhere around 35% of healthcare costs that we pay for healthcare services either do no good or do harm. And evidence-based medicine looks at grades of evidence of what's the best thing to do. Our science has expanded so much. An example that I mentioned last night with Representative Newman, for example, cardiac stents, where you put the little stent in your coronary artery to keep it open so that the heart muscle doesn't die and you have a heart attack, that those can be wonderful when they're needed to be done. But about a third of the time, which means hundreds of thousands of times a year in the United States, a third of the time they are placed for what is called chronic stable angina. Now, there were very solid, high-grade evidence studies that showed that that was no better than just standard medical treatment in terms of preventing heart attacks, in terms of relieving anginal pain, pain when you have exertion, and that the costs were much, much higher. Boston Scientific at that time was the main manufacturer of stents. Their stock took a hit for about a year, and they bounced back up, and there was no impact. And today, a third of stents are put in for chronic stable angina. That does not need to be done. The evidence does not support it. And that's probably, I don't know, $30,000, $40,000 anyway each for several hundred thousand a year. It's a lot of money. And you can go through many, many things. In my own career, I have done things before we became as aware of evidence-based medicine I really thought was the right thing to do. I have talked about when in the old Quonset hut at the old Kanackanack Hospital, how I treated the kids that would come in with pussy running ears. It was as common as a cold in those days. And I've done it when Dick Monsager, who is a longtime friend of the director of the Providence Hospital now and a pediatrician, and when I do it, I say, Dick, close your ears. Oh, you will be shocked at what I did. I thought I was doing the right thing. But we learn more, and within the concept of evidence-based medicine, there is a potential for huge savings. And it comes into play in two areas. One is in coverage decisions. Are you going to pay for everything that everybody wants? And I may mention something that somebody in this room really believes in. But for example, chelation therapy for cardiovascular disease was real popular for a while, still is done. The evidence is not there. And if you're paying for coverage, should the taxpayer, should the employer need to pay for that when the evidence shows it really doesn't do any good? We're a free country. If you want to go get it on your own, you can do it. But that's an example that I say I recognize could step on somebody's toes. The evidence is not there. So the payer decisions need to be based on evidence of what are you going to cover. Secondly, the clinical decision needs to be there. The physician's role has evolved. So in the days when I first came here, I think if I had told a patient, I'm sorry, we're going to need to amputate your arm, the answer would be, thank you very much, doctor. It was frightening to have that much faith in physicians. And physicians generally try to do the right thing today. But we have evolved. People are more knowledgeable. And the physician now becomes an educator as well as a doer. I'm a surgeon, so it would be my job to take out your cancer in your colon or your gallbladder if you needed that done and so on. But my job is also to educate you of what are the risks, what are the benefits, what are the alternatives. If you're a man, do you get a PSA, a prostate-specific antigen test done? If you go to almost any urologist, they would say, absolutely. You're endangering yourself. You're stupid if you don't do it. I do not have PSA tests done. I have had one done in my life, and that was because it was an accident, because of a blood panel. I believe the evidence indicates that there's more surgery done based on those decisions, and I think that evidence is good. Clearly, there's a difference of opinion. But, for example, when I was leading the non-primary care portion of group health in Puget Sound area, what we had our physicians do we felt the evidence didn't support it, but there was enough controversy. We said your role is to present the pros and the cons to the patient, and then collaboratively you make a decision there on what to do based on the evidence. So it comes into play in coverage decisions, it comes into play in clinical decisions, but potential for in our $2.7 trillion healthcare cost now, the potential for saving probably close to $1 trillion. I'll turn it back to Deb.
And back to Representative Costello's point and question earlier, the Commission has identified increasing price and quality transparency as a critical strategy and have some more specific recommendations about that. Dr. Hurlburt mentioned the feasibility study we're doing right now on a specific type of database, all-payer claims database, that would support public reporting of prices and some aspects of quality of care. And we're going to continue delving into this over the next year. At our next meeting on March 7th, we're actually going to be looking at examples of laws, state laws from other states that have required providers to provide more transparency in their prices and different aspects of quality. So we'll have more specific recommendations coming in the future related to that and more information. Paying for value is another strategic area that we've developed a number of recommendations around, and that's related to the need to start moving away for fees for individual services and the individual diaper and trying to look at, and back to Dr. Hurlburt's earlier example, looking at how we can bundle payments together, and we've been following the collaboration.
Recording stopped.
In the good work that Commissioner Stewart and Commissioner Hultberg have been doing together to collaborate around questions related to how we pay for care. Engaging employers as a major payer for health care in our state is another suggested strategy, and we did partner with Commonwealth North this past year to bring host a forum with some expertise from outside to look at what large employers are starting to do to try to drive improvements both on the prevention end, improving employee health and wellness, reducing absenteeism, and at the same time supporting them to be more proactive consumers, and improving how health plans are organized to drive improved value in health care. Enhancing quality and efficiency of care on the front end, if we recognizing the value and the importance of primary care and getting folks good preventative and early care and better supporting reimbursement for that. We also have some recommendations related to improving the state's trauma care system and that related to that strategic area. We spent some time this past year studying the quality and availability of end-of-life care and other issues related to end-of-life planning this past year. And we have some recommendations related to that. And some of those would require state legislation, just for example, creation of electronic registry for advanced directives and support for moving the state's Comfort One program that's established in statute to physician's orders for life-sustaining treatment program. We have a series of recommendations related to the importance of focusing on prevention and specific to concerns related to obesity, immunization, and behavioral health. And finally, a couple of areas that are kind of cross-cutting systems issues where we have a series of recommendations related to improving the health information infrastructure, everything from electronic health records and health information exchange to telemedicine and data systems that support decision-making and also workforce. And so those just give you a taste. Again, you have a handout that shows a compilation of all of the more specific recommendations to date. And I just wanted to mention that the Commission has not been addressing Affordable Care Act provisions directly, but we do at each meeting have some time just to update ourselves. We're watching what's happening with that and gathering information related to implementation of the Affordable Care Act, since that's of course, is a very significant piece
for the members' information. We will probably have the Commission come and talk to us when we get into the Affordable Care Act expansion on that.
So a few points on next steps over this next year. We plan to spend a little more time getting into how healthcare accounting and pricing works, and looking at health insurance costs and cost drivers, and spending more time developing some more specific recommendations related to evidence-based medicine, transparency, and employer engagement.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you, Doctor. Any other questions? Representative Guerra?
We all want to make sure the money's being spent properly, right? And I'm just curious on the obesity program that we have. We've got 57% of schools serving nutritional lunches, 43% not. We have spotty PE around the state. Those are ways to address obesity. What's the obesity funding money being spent on that we've put in the budget?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we spend it on working with the school districts. We spend it on some media expenses there. The amount of money in the base budget, there formerly was some federal money that we lost a few years ago, and actually championed sponsored by Representative Holmes. About 3 years ago, we have $400,000 in the base budget. We try to, within the budget we have, we look for other opportunities to leverage that, because it is the number one public health problem. And as the state's chief medical officer, I believe if I don't try to address that and encourage that, I'm not the right person for the job. So the funding is limited, but we try to do it collaboratively, partnering with school districts, with other organizations, getting the message out to people, because just like smoking, you know, when I was young, you saw doctors in white coats advertising cigarettes, saying it's good for your T-zone. But when the schools started teaching differently, and the kids came home and harassed their parents, "Mom, Dad, why are you smoking?" It was kind of a breakthrough. Carrie Fisher, who's the acting director of the Division of Public Health, lives out in Eagle River and has a child in school there. Her little first grade boy is coming home saying, "Mom, what's the nutritional value of this food?" Or, "You know, Mom, how many calories are in that?" We may be starting to get the word out a little bit. So.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I think working with school districts is a good idea, especially if you're doing more on PE and nutritional food. One thing I think is always ineffective is when I go to a state office and I see pamphlets sitting around that nobody reads and reports that nobody reads. So I just want to make sure that the obesity funding isn't being spent on stuff like that, but it's being spent on things that are actually leading to results.
Can we just get a report from the commission on how that money is spent, or from the department? Thank you. Representative Wilson.
And on the same thing, Mr. Chair, how do you even measure results, though? I mean, you could talk about 57% nutrition in school lunches, but not every child has a school lunch. You know, they may not even be able to afford a school lunch. And I know we have programs that you can sign up, but I have a particular school that dropped off that's not a Title I school, and it's not because the area became richer. Because more parents decide not to fill out those types. So when you're measuring all those, because we could talk about obesity in children, but we know that it comes to the family life, the parents, things that I don't think government should have control over. So how do you measure the success of those types of programs when you really only can touch it, in a small way?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I absolutely agree. It's a very complex problem. I believe it's going to be a bigger challenge than tobacco was, because we all have to eat, there's so much implied. I think we need to foster the understanding that the increasing body mass index, the increasing overweight and obesity that we've seen, is not good for us. We do live longer than we used to, but the White House report, championed by Michelle Obama, pointed out that this generation of Americans now being born may be the first generation since the founding of our country to not live as long as their parents because of the medical complications of overweight and obesity. So we need when I was young, nobody in my family smoked. But if a guest came who smoked, they expected you to have an ashtray. That was being a good host. Now, if somebody came and wanted to smoke, if you're polite, you would say, I beg your pardon, or could you step outside? Or if you're not polite, you might say something stronger than that. But it's taken decades. I think it'll take a long time, but it's a huge challenge, and we have to address it because it's going to kill more people than anything else.
I understand that, Mr. Chair, but, you know, this is a financial impact, too. I mean, go to the store and look how much fruit cost, you know, based on junk food. You know, you could go and buy a lot more junk food a lot cheaper than you can things that are healthy for you. You know, and so there's, you know, so if we're giving food stamps or even those kinds of things, and I have to stretch it out and I can buy more, you know, and I know potato chips is probably a bad thing, but potato chips versus bananas, and I have to feed, you know, and I don't want them to be hungry, are, you know, what kind of choices are they making, financial choices that we really don't have any control over? So I think most parents want their children to be healthy, but I think it comes down to a lot of times, I know when I was raising mine, it came down to the price of what it was, and although I would rather bought the other, it's just not affordable. So I'm just really curious whether how you make that connection on affordability back to, again, things cost so much more to get here in Alaska, and, you know, we don't want our kids to go hungry. We want to be healthy, I completely agree, but I think more of this comes down to finances than necessarily just choices.
I think that was more of a statement there, and we'll look at that. I think.
I had a question later. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I think Representative Edgman would like to say, well, with bypass mail and trying to get fresh produce out into the villages, you know, and some of the impacts that have happened there, it's just there's so many things that are going on right now. We need to wrap up by quarter after here so people can get ready for our floor session. I'd just like to state, though, that, you know, so far at this time, this is our last presentation that we're doing through the department right now. It's a formal presentation before we get into increments and decrements. And we've had 12 meetings with 15 different presentations, and I think it's been a very thorough discussion of what we've had. And you know, under the direction of Co-Chair Osterman, of trying to make sure we get as much good, accurate information out there to the public as we can as we try and delve into this budget, you know, and understand it as fully as we can because of the complexities of it. And as we move into the future with less revenues available to the state and how we're going to be able to fund a lot of these operations. So thank you for that. And thank you for your members and your attention. It's a lot of great questions, and we'll continue on down this. We're just going to have to watch for upcoming meetings. We're now negotiating and talking back and forth with the commissioner and members, too, on where we'll be working on, again, those increments and decrements that we need to be dealing with next. So thank you, Dr. and Deborah. Thank you for your attention.